Philosophers.
Philosophers. I can't.
What, you can't take my sarcastic coffee sipping?
Nope.
Well, it's too bad because we're leaving it in. Unless you want to cut it out later. So, we did not prepare a topic again this week because we are lazy or busy, whatever excuse people commonly use. But we did take a look at the last two topics we've discussed, and that was authority versus power in episode 23, and then terrorism in episode 24. And there's an interesting linkage there that I don't think we acknowledged. And there were some assumptions we made that I think were maybe unfair to assume. So the linkage between the two is essentially people who commit acts of terrorism often see it as them denying or acting in opposition to the authority of some other institution. And you'll often hear them talk about how there's no peaceful way, or their protests are useless. They can no longer abide within that same system. As we had suggested in our episode on authority versus power, they can't stay within the system and oppose its authority any longer. Like, they are getting too, you know, and this is not a devil's advocate for terrorism, okay? Just a preface, but that's some things you hear. And then the second assumption we made is that terrorism is bad. So we're going to take those two things and we're going to talk a little bit about what we think is considerable recourse for actions. At what point is a protest okay? At what point do you protest as a group? And give your time on a Saturday, you know, up from doing little micro protests, like not paying your taxes till the day they're due because you don't want to give the government a loan, for example. That's a very micro form of protest and all this stuff. At what point do you have to go from that to where you need to defend yourself, or at what point are words no longer enough, you know, and stuff like that? So let's start by addressing the assumption we made last week, and that is terrorism is bad.
So I think the assumption that terrorism is bad comes from the other conclusions we talked about before, that basically initiating a coercive relationship is bad. And so terrorists are seen as the instigators, you know, because they normally are outsiders to the mainstream social norms. And so then when they commit their acts, they are disrupting what would otherwise be social order. And so they're seen as the aggressors. And so we see this as, you know, since they threw the first blow, as it were, that they're the ones at fault.
Like, and let's go ahead and just go jump to the most extreme example that I think is imprinted on most Americans' mind. 9/11 seemed totally unprovoked to your average American. We didn't do nothing to Al-Qaeda. So why would they fly planes into our buildings and kill hundreds of... I don't even know what the death toll was or what all could be attributed to, but kill people, you know. However, if you look at some of the justifications given, now granted, this is also going to kind of rub against taboo territory, because the general notion is we don't negotiate with terrorists, and that we don't, by committing terrorism, we don't care what you have to say anymore. We addressed that last week and how that's maybe not the best approach. You must acknowledge their reasons, and then you can attack the reasons on their own. Like, you can separate the reasons from the act in a lot of times and address them separately. You can condemn an act while acknowledging there might be some nuggets of truth in the reasons for doing it. I'm not an expert on Middle Eastern or Middle Asian politics, but Al-Qaeda had what they considered to be adequate reasons for doing what they did. But that's a conversation that no one ever had, really.
And it was kind of a taboo subject to talk about at the time, or you would have been seen as a sympathizer, you know.
So, I guess what we need to look at are, you know, what are some are there valid reasons, I guess, for doing something so drastic? Or maybe something less drastic, you know?
Right. So, you know, and really what it's going to come down to as far as the way anyone else is going to see it is just the optics of it. That, you know, 9/11 looked terrible because basically nobody else around agreed with them. But, you know, you take the case of, I'm gonna forget the name of this town.
It's the one in Montana that we're talking about? The Rancher Rebellion not too long ago?
No.
Oh.
But yes, a rebellion. I don't think it was in Montana. I thought it was in, like, Tennessee or Kentucky anyway.
Oh.
Basically, corrupt local government starts doing corrupt local government things. People get fed up with it. They manage to get some arms from the local armory and go storm the Capitol.
How long ago was this?
Is this
a historical event, or is this more modern history?
Like a few decades. I think 20th century, but I don't remember. Don't remember where. Anyway, and so they threw out literally the I don't know the whole scope of who was ejected from the local government, but regardless, they, by way of force, kicked those people out of the local government. I think this was very local, like city or county.
Right.
But you know, and so these people were not really seen as terrorists. You know, there were no counter-terroristic measures taken against them later. There was probably some court proceedings following it, but I don't think that any of them were convicted of anything.
Yeah. I think more recent example,
the Battle of Athens, that was called.
Oh, okay. I'll need to look that up because I don't know anything about that. The one I do recall, and there's a little bit more recent, was between the federal government. It wasn't all the way to the federal government. It was a bunch of ranchers who, I want to say they were out in Montana, the Midwest somewhere, out in the middle of nowhere, who let their cattle graze on what was claimed to be federal land, because the further you get out west, the more land is owned by the federal government directly.
Yeah, go look up a map of that sometime. Go look up a map of United States federally owned land and just see how the West just turns, you know, normally because people are trying to push an agenda with it, it's colored red, so it turns red as you go west. So
right. And there's also a good CPG Gray video about it. I did say it right that time, right?
No.
CGP Gray?
Yes.
Damn it. Okay, well, I will put that in here as well. A CGP Gray video about what is federal land in the United States and how it came to be. It's a pretty good brief synopsis on the situation, I think, without being politically biased one way or the other. So, but this dealt directly with that, and it was a bunch of ranchers who let their cattle roam on this land because it wasn't being used, and the federal government said that they couldn't do that because of some environmental reason. I can't remember. There was some reason why they couldn't, but the ranchers let them do it anyway. They took the whole approach of I'm going to do it until you make me stop, essentially. Well, after a while, the federal government in the form of the FBI got involved, and the FBI sent armed people out there to deal with this situation and make these people stop. Well, these people, being ranchers in the Midwest, are armed to the teeth, most of them, and they actually stood off with the FBI for a couple of weeks before the FBI just left them alone, because the more this became publicized, the more the public opinion was shown that people kind of were more on the side of the ranchers, and the government just kind of let it go after a while, and then it just went hush after that. Like, no one talked about it really quickly afterwards, which I think is what tends to happen a lot of times with successful retaliations against a government, especially one in the United States, which is based very, very heavily on democracy, where optics is everything as far as leadership is concerned. So that's another interesting event where they were armed, and I don't know if they killed anybody. I do want to say shots were exchanged, but I don't know that anyone was killed or injured. But there was a violent, potentially violent standoff that occurred between the federal agents of the federal government and independent individuals in these form of these Midwestern ranchers, you know. Now, and like we had said before, the only difference between us calling these people terrorists or maybe resistance fighters or freedom fighters are other very good propagandable terms as for how you can put people doing something you might have disagreed with if you were on the other side in a good light. It has a lot to do with optics. But I don't think we should leave certain things to be just about people's subjective opinion, because that's what optics are. Optics, in a way, are people's perceived, people's perceptions of the event and their response to it.
Well, literally, in the place where the term comes from, is it's how people see the event.
Right. But the difference, I think, between just being how people perceive it, though, is that you can affect this perception. Like, for example, you know, people in the mainstream media, you know, or conspiracy theory, anyone with a mouthpiece and an audience can add their own take or spin on any realistic event and not step outside of maybe the fuzzy boundaries of the truth, but they can change the framing of the issue to change the optics. So, and this happens all, this is propaganda is all it is. This happens all the time. Especially in war times, you know, the U.S., if you look at people's opinions on war during World War II, it was incredibly pro-war because we dehumanized the enemy and we looked upon ourselves as this glorious angel of, you know, light and protection for the rest of the world. But however, when you get towards Vietnam, when the optics changed and the media did not support this war and the war was considered unfavorable, we looked at ourselves as tyrants. And so, and it's amazing how much support it takes to get a country to be involved in a total war like that. But this is very similar, but it's on a much more, a much smaller scale. But I still don't like it. I think that we can find some objective reasons as to when it's justified and when it's not, or at least maybe some metric that doesn't just rely on your proximity to the issue, you know?
Sure. So, I mean, like, the thing is that I will assert that any solution to this will rely on people accepting similar axioms to one another. Like we can look at this objectively as long as we all agree on what our standards are.
Sure. I can accept that.
Sure. So if we take something like, let's take, for example, the non-aggression principle. If we take this as a principle, then we can see whether somebody's an aggressor.
Right. There is one thing, though, about the non-aggression principle I think we need to address first, and that is I know some people that look at the non-aggression principle as an eye for an eye type situation, which there is, I can see why they get there, don't get me wrong, but it's not quite that way. For example, if you aggress against me, I am then allowed to respond in kind. Right? Now, that sounds a lot like an eye for an eye, but there's a point where it goes too far. And now there's, and we got to be careful here as well, because there's another subjective thing called what a reasonable person would do. And the damn reasonable person out there that doesn't exist changed my mind. We have to temper what that is, you know, like, just take an example. If you steal from me, and I know you did, I watched you do it, and I come out to try to stop you, and I'm unable to stop you, you know, like, say you have a gun, and I don't have my gun on me at that time, which is my own fault for not being able to protect myself or my property, but you steal it anyway. Am I then justified in then going and getting my gun, and then marching over to your property and taking it back, right?
Right.
But am I justified in going over to your property at gunpoint, taking it back, and then taking something else.
Right.
But at what point is it, you know, because you cost me time as well, and you cost me effort, and I lost out on potential value there, which we're not going to go all the way down that road, I don't think, at this moment, but
right, we can hire an accountant and figure out exactly how much they owe you after putting you through this.
Exactly, but I feel like, and I hate to say this, but there's a valuable metric, I guess, when it comes to subjectivity that everyone, I think, knows what I'm talking about when I'll say this, but no one can prove to me what it is, and that is, you know it when you see it.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's a boo, but still, it's true. Like, if I said, you know it, like, the age-old one is pornography. What is porn? Well, when you sit down and try to define what is considered pornography in the actual broad sense of the word, you know it when you see it, but that also has a lot to do with your own sensibilities and definitions as an individual. You know, some people might consider, you know, clothes on provocative acts are just as pornographic as nudity. And some people, as long as there's no acts of sex happening, it's not porn. You know, like, it depends a lot on the subjectivity of the observer. And I think what we're seeing with things like these events that have occurred in the United States that aren't terrorism, it's because the aggregate opinion of the public determines whether or not it's okay or not. And that's what we're trying to get away from. So it's going to, I think it's, I don't even know really where to start with this. I mean, we can start with the non-aggression principle, but it's going to, even that, I think, has its own subjectivity problems baked in.
Well, that's right. You know, because, well, you know, there are cases that have been made for the non-aggression principle, which do their best not to rely on subjectivity, like the one that I've mentioned before, which is Chad Perrin's Moral Caution essay. But even that, the principle of that is basically nobody wants to do evil, whatever that might be.
Right.
But what if you do? Like,
but what if you do want to do evil? I don't know. I think we won't get there metaphysically. I think this is going to have to be something taken pragmatically at first, and through time and time again examples, you might be able to discover a trend, that a causal trend that will help us be able to figure it out. Because the fact of the matter is, we already deal with this. We already deal with aggregate subjective opinion. But there's also, I think, two types of aggregate subjective opinion. There is the talk, and then there's the action for subjective opinion. For example, you can be a very outspoken individual towards something, but you will never, but the barrier for you to take action is so far above what the peak of your outspoken and outrage is. Like, for example, today we, you know, some people say that we have an outrage culture where any activity in the public court of opinion will, if it draws enough outrage, it will scare people away from the topic. And this outrage is nothing but words. And in a lot of times, it's digital opinions in the form of social media, you know. And people go from 0 to 100 really fast because they're not standing in front of somebody and tempering themselves like they would in a social setting. For example, if you go to like a town hall meeting and you're there, you might witness one aggregate opinion, and that might be displeasure at the event. But if you look at the Twitter feed for the same event, you would think that this was a
riot,
a riot, or, you know, people protesting the Reichstag, you know, like something crazy. However, when you take both of these groups of people, how many of them are actually going to get their gun and come on down there and try to stop these people? Or how many people are going to go get their pitchforks and stuff like that? And, you know, that limit, the limit for that to occur is so far beyond, it seems, at times what people will show outrage to, right?
Right. So I have a pragmatic proposition to get around the problem of subjectivity in this case, although you may not like it.
I mean, we got to start somewhere.
Until someone die. No, I'm just kidding. Terrorism is a smear word, an insult thrown at people, in order to, you know, basically just to intensify a condemnation. And the reality here is that there is violence, whether political or otherwise, and it may or may not be justified.
Okay. Well, this brings me to, this is sounding a lot like a book I read once upon a time. And I've mentioned this book often because I do find it to be a super fascinating book for what it is. Starship Troopers talks a lot about the concept of violence. I don't remember the exact quote, but in this novel, there is a class that the protagonist attends. And he attends this class multiple times in his life. Once when he's in high school, once when he gets inducted into the military, and once when he, near the end of the novel, when he is moving into his final, into the peak of his career, into becoming an officer, he has to take it again. And this class is called History and Moral Philosophy. And in this, and it's through this class, the author, Robert Heinlein, is able to essentially pulpit his ideas to the reader directly through the mouthpiece of the teachers in these classes. And you, the reader, are in the place of the protagonist, and you get, and you have an omniscient view of what he thinks. It's first person omniscience. So one concept he talks a lot about is how violence is unavoidable, and that violence is the only way human beings actually communicate anything, or that violence is the language of authority. What if you're not willing to commit an act of violence, no matter how mild? Because, for example, even he would go so far as to say that you can talk about something all day, but when two people are starkly opposed, it must resort to violence to that's where you have the real debate. And he essentially says that without violence, there is no peace, or there's no way to, at the risk of sounding too 1984 on it, without violence, there's no way for us to have an adequate discussion to show what we really mean, because violence is a core part of the, us being animals, you know, humans are animals. Violence is the only thing that actually gets the point across enough. And it will always serve, because we will never be able to achieve a state of rationality above our instincts. That's the assertion. Or at least we won't for a very long time. So until we reach that point, violence is the point at which you have to communicate your opinion. And he gets to this point. It's his justification for why veterans are the only people with political empowerment to do anything. It's because they have demonstrated their willingness to use violence to defend what they believe, essentially. And so wrapping all that back down to where we are now, if you are not willing to commit an act, and you don't have to commit an act of violence, there's a stark distinction between being willing to and actually committing an act of violence. If you're not willing to commit an act of violence in the name of your principles, then they're not principles, and you don't really believe them enough. And there's a great deal of responsibility leading up to that too, where you're responsible for what you say, but that's pretty hollow. You must be willing to be responsible for what you do. So if you take, for example, a violent act, and this violent act could just be standing in someone's way. It's not that you are hitting them or pushing them back. You are just standing there.
It's a very loose definition of violence by our standards.
It is, though. Violence is essentially when, I think the best definition you could give for violence is when two people have to engage physically for there to be any
progress made at that point. Because, for example, if there's a narrow doorway and you want to go through the doorway and I am standing in the doorway, there is no way for you to get through me without using violence, even if it's just pushing me out of the way. You can try to talk me out of the doorway, but ultimately, if I am deaf to everything you have to say, you have to engage in violence to get me out of that doorway. You know what I'm saying? To move forward. And that violent confrontation, while on an individual scale, might be seen as somewhat unfair because there will be always those who are more physically dominatory over others. On a societal scale, and that's really what he's trying to address, is libertarian principles in the context of a society. How do you make that work? It is what people are willing to commit violence to achieve. And by doing that, you are taking your principles on as responsibilities by putting them into action in the form of violence. And that's when any two people come into conflict with one another, essentially, is what he's saying. So I don't know how that's what, when you're saying, you know, terrorism is a smear word, that's kind of what it's bringing me to, is the, okay, it might be a smear word, but if that's the case, is the only way you can truly get your point across when all dialogue breaks down is violence?
When all dialogue breaks down...
Like when words are no longer enough. Like we have reached a standstill where no matter what you say, I'm not changing my mind. And no matter what I say, you're not changing your mind. Violence is the only next step.
I don't know that... Well, okay. Other factors matter before I will accept that violence is the only next step.
Okay.
You know, because it depends on the severity and importance of the disagreement. First of all, you know, because if it's something that people can ultimately get over, then they will.
Right, and that's the point, is, and what he was saying is that if no one is willing to engage in violence, no one's willing to start it, then it can go away because people aren't that dedicated to getting their way. If it's not something you truly have to do, you won't engage in violence to get it. And because it's not important enough to you, because if it was important enough, you will go to those links. You know, a good example of that is if, you know, how important is your most prized possession? You know, if it's, is it important enough that you would fight somebody if they tried to take it? Or would you just let them steal it? You know, and it's because he walks away from essentially the principled part of libertarianism, which is, it doesn't matter if I want it enough. It matters that my principles say that it's wrong. And so I will engage on strict principle alone, when that maybe doesn't line up all the way with reality, you know. There's a reason to believe that people will be allowed to be pushed around to a certain point because they will make sacrifices on things that aren't as important to maintain the things that are, you know? And so when you reach a social equilibrium, when people are bumping against each other all the time, and finally you reach a place where I'm willing to commit violence, you're willing to commit violence, but we both know that we're both willing to commit violence and we really don't want to go there, so we just stop. And that's the new boundary for authority between these two people. But it's that occurring on a multi-layered scale, where it's you versus everybody else and everybody else versus everybody else, all on a one-to-one matchup. You know, you can push as far until you get to the point where you're not willing to exert violence anymore and no one else is willing to exert violence against you. That is equilibrium. And that's how you attain a peaceful society, is everyone is comfortable enough with their territory. And that's not just physical territory. That's, you know, I'm not being infringed on enough this way or this way. No one's really doing anything that I think is so bad that I'm going to commit violence against. And I am now in equilibrium and I can engage peacefully with people within, this is my sphere. And I have pushed the sphere as far as I'm able to sustain, and as far as people are willing to allow me to sustain it. And in this sphere, I am a free agent, and everyone has their own sphere, and they're all kind of rubbing against each other. And every so often, you'll have one that tries to encroach on the other, and violence might occur to settle the difference. But it's not just between those two. It's your entire network versus their entire network. And this is all under the assumption that we're rational enough to see the outcome or the likely outcome and have instincts enough to know whether or not it's really worth it or not. And there's no room in this type of society for gambling as far as, I'm going to just keep pushing to see how far I can go, because you acknowledge that there's a real threat that someone might actually smack you back down into your place if you're poking your head where you don't belong, you know, and some people might take that risk. But when you get smacked back down to where you belong, no one's going to help you because most people would acknowledge that you've gone too far. And so that's kind of what he's talking about when it comes to violence being an essentially not the boundaries between acts of violence is what forms the fabric of society that allows it to exist with an equilibrium, because everyone within their own sphere at optimal time is not willing to exert violence to go any further, and no one else is willing to exert violence to keep you, to push you back in. And that's how you achieve equilibrium in that case. That was a bunch of word salad to kind of explain his point on that. And don't get me wrong, it takes a lot to get to that point. I feel like there's some mental hoops you have to jump through and one of those is taking the modern definition of violence and throwing it out the window, because violence is commonly seen as negative, right?
Right.
Right. But instead of looking at it as just a negative part of humanity, this requires that you have to just acknowledge it as an integral part of interaction between animals. And that's what he does. And that's what his whole novel is about, is how violence is innate to us. And so instead of trying to suppress it, use it as a tool to essentially create a social fabric. But you have to put that in balance with rationality and self-interest. And those two things together is what allows a society to reach conclusions on every level, from a one-to-many scale to a one-to-one scale. Because ultimately, words don't matter when you get to a certain point. And I think that's, I think there's some truth there, right? Because even in today, there are people who protest and protest and protest about some things and they never get changed. And it's because no one cares what you have to say anymore. Like, you can, once you've screeched at the loud of, you know, at the loudest you can get and no one changes, that's everyone signaling to you that keep screeching, we're not changing our minds, you know? And if you really cared, if you really wanted to, if you really wanted to see your change made, you would take action at that point. And it's not just, I'm going to walk down a street with a sign action, because that, I don't think, changes anyone's minds. It's, I'm going to, and you can view this in the form of what we would now consider nonviolent protests, you know? Like, if you look at the civil rights movement, nonviolent protests in the form of blocking highways or what was it called, where they would just occupy every seat on a bus, you know, I forget what that's called, or sit-ins, you know. Those are actually violent protests, according
by this definition.
By this definition, those are violence, because you are physically acting against the interests of someone else directly. Like, if you organize a sit-in at a diner, you are preventing that diner from doing what it wants to do by physically being present. You cannot sell food to anybody because there's nowhere for them to sit. That has almost the same effect as them standing outside and beating up anybody who would come in. You know what I mean? It's just not direct towards a third party. It's direct against your opponent, right? In this concept of violence, they're the same. Violence is looked at more by your willingness to just physically act. That's all violence really is physical action that directly impedes against another person. So, I don't know what you have to say about that, but that's his idea on it. And I'm not saying that's the best idea, but I do think that there's some interesting thought pieces in there that I haven't heard decent enough. I haven't heard a good enough reason that rebuts it that I'm willing to just throw it out yet.
It's a lot to think about.
For sure.
You know, and the verbiage on its own, you know, just given our culture, is very inflammatory.
Sure.
So I imagine that a lot of people will hear that Probably get about halfway through that and stop. You know, just because of the verbiage, but yeah, I mean, under consideration, there's definitely a point there.
So if we change the verbiage, then.
Well, I don't know that the verbiage necessarily needs changing. It's just that it probably should be delivered
more delicately than I'm able to right now.
Perhaps. Well, I guess the way I was going to put it is that definitions should have been established first. Because that's where a lot of it come. That's what a lot of it comes down to is definitions.
Well, and admittedly, Robert Heinlein does a lot better job of because it's his philosophy. So of course he's going to do a better job of explaining it than I can. And he does, if I recall correctly, he defines things first. So
sure. So all right. Now the question we're trying to answer is. When is it acceptable to exert force on others in the colloquial sense of the term, which is, you know, not merely physically impeding, but going so far as to seriously injure or kill people.
Right. And to be fair, the definitions I've laid out, it sidesteps this whole thing because it says, according to it, it's the same. There's no difference. And the time at which you would do this is still subjective because it really just depends on the will of the individual at the time and or the will of the individuals involved separately. And so it essentially sidesteps the question and says that there is no way to objectively lay out a standard necessarily. You could create one, but that would require everyone being in agreeance on an objective reality. Good luck. But I think it also offers a roadmap to get there because another part of his novelization that I'm banking pretty heavily on right now, to be honest, is it glimpses at the history of how the society got to that point and accepting that morality. And it was that society got there because groups of people of like-mindedness exerted their will against others. There was struggle. And it was those who, it's one of the shortcomings, it essentially says that there's almost this divine will without pointing to a god. It's that people know what is right deep down, and so they will support what is right when they see it. And that's your objective truth, is that we're able to detect it without being able to define it directly. And so through these struggles, these people were able to exert their will enough on others to reach a point where the common, even if everyone didn't agree, those who disagreed weren't at the point where they were willing to commit violence to change it. You essentially reach a valley in potential energy where people aren't willing to exert energy to change the system anymore because it's not bad. They may not like it, but they can't justify it enough to act out against it. And so it's almost this mystical thing where we all just kind of know what's right deep down, or we can acknowledge, or there's something innate in our ability to just be able to know when there's something right or wrong, even if we're not consciously aware of it. And I don't like that, to be honest.
Because I was going to say that's a pretty bold assertion.
It is a bold assertion, but it's an assertion made that people deep down know what's right and what's wrong. And even if you don't consciously know what it is, subconsciously you do, and you will act out violently against things that you subconsciously know are wrong, whereas you won't for things that are right. Even if you disagree with the things that are right and agree with the things that are wrong, the actual threshold for your subconscious ability to exert your will against it is when you're going to be brought to violence, which, again, I acknowledge is probably not true.
But the thing here is that this doesn't sidestep subjectivity here.
Because it embraces subjectivity, essentially.
Right. Well, you know, I guess the way you phrased it made it seem like you were defending an assertion that deep down we all know what's right and wrong, as if there's some objective right and wrong that we all know. But that's not true. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these conflicts in the first place.
Well, I think the way it's put, again, I'll get off this horse here in a minute. Okay, I promise. But I do think, because I'm also pondering this out, because I've not had a chance to really demonstrate it in a discussion to see where the obvious holes are. And even though the longer we have this discussion, I acknowledge that this is one of them. You would almost have to, in order to accept this entire philosophy wholeheartedly, you would have to acknowledge there is, it goes back to almost what the same roots that rational morality takes, right? We've discussed rational morality before, haven't we?
Yes.
And the roots, and what are those roots of rational morality? Like, what is a way you can reach and achieve morality without a god, but or anyone telling you what it is, but you can reach it rationally from axioms?
Well, yeah, you can reach it from axioms, but axioms are themselves just baseless assertions, really.
Right, but it does the same thing, is it makes baseless assertions, and from those axioms is able to reach its conclusion, because there's almost an optimistic view on humanity you have to accept.
Sure, I'm not disputing an optimistic view on humanity. I think that by and large, you know, people are good and want to be good. But we, in our pursuit of being good and being well-intentioned, we still have different intuitions about what exactly is the right thing.
Right, it acknowledges that. It doesn't sidestep that at all. But what it's saying is, it acknowledges that we're unable to maybe do this with 100% accuracy, right? So instead of trusting our perceptions on what is right and wrong, it takes it one level deeper and inserts that there is your willingness to act is different than your ability to perceive, right?
Right.
And it instead of trusting your perceptions on what is right or wrong to help you determine what you should do, it takes it one level, what it would say is deeper. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is deeper, but it says whatever you are willing to actually act against. And so, and I think in doing that, it's trying to address directly the problem of violence instead of the problem of what is right or wrong. It is, instead of saying what is right or wrong is what matters, it's what are people realistically going to do regardless of whatever right or wrong is, what are they going to be willing to act out violently for?
Sure. I think this really is pretty close to my proposition earlier, which is that terrorism is kind of a meaningless term in the sense that...
Right.
Because basically, you know, if we take a religious terrorist, this person was apparently willing to take it that far, and did.
Yeah, because they did.
Right, yeah. It's obvious that they were willing to, because they did. But, we're, you know, for all intents and purposes, nobody else sees it that way.
Right, but that's not...
Nobody else sees it as justified.
Right, but the thing is, it doesn't matter if people see it as justified, are people going to act back? And we did. Well, when I say we, the people of the United States did. Like, we authorized indirectly force on other people. We tacitly accepted the individuals who said, I'll go over there and exert my force back against it.
But I guess that's what I what I was saying is that the term terrorist is just a label that we put on people who commit acts of political violence with which we disagree.
Right. And that's, yeah. And if we agreed with it, it would be called, you know,
heroism.
Heroism. Or, and that's exactly right. Because, you know, you could, from the, like, if you flip the perspective, say you're an Afghan native that you just, you're a farmer or a sheep herder or whatever, you just live there and you're doing your thing, and you see some other guy, some white man show up that's in a camo uniform with a gun, and he walks into, him and a bunch of his buddies walk into a building that is in your village, and they shoot up the place, you think, man, that's terrorism. You know, they're trying to change the political landscape of where I'm from. But over here, we accept those people back with open arms and with decorations, you know. And I think one of the biggest problems with that is that, well, there's a tribalistic element, A, and B, it's that there is no universal perspective. No one has the third person perspective on the whole thing that you could trust. Like, you can't trust yourself to be unbiased in it, because you will innately benefit from one, or you'll benefit from one or the other, you know, and whichever one you tend to benefit from, you will tend to side with. And I think what is being said about the your willingness to exert violence is that what this system allows for as well is you to acknowledge you benefit, but still act out violently against it. And because I think that's also a truth. You know, you could be a part of a system that you benefit from, but still think it's wrong and act out violently against it, you know. And because that happens too. It's just a lot more complicated. I think another thing that makes this more complicated is that there's a group dynamic that exists as well beyond the individual dynamic. For example, most Americans are not actually willing to exert violence against an external force. If you're looking at this on a nation's game, most of us, let's take Gaddafi, for example. Everyone, from what we've heard about Gaddafi, was that he was a terrible person, and he supported terrorists if he wasn't a terrorist himself, right? He was a tyrant, he was a dictator. He was doing things that were wrong, okay? Now, if you ask the average American, okay, are you going to sign up to join the military to go over there and exert your force against it? No. Most people won't. But we exist in a society that allows us to defer that violence to someone else and say, no, but I will support someone else who does it on my behalf. And that makes it, I think, a little more complicated, because now, and because one thing that in Highline's novel is that it's focused on the soldier itself. There's a reason Johnny Rico is a soldier. That's why you're put in his shoes, because he is the first person exerting violence against another force, right? You don't look at it from the perspective of the civilian, because they don't matter, for example, because they're not willing to exert force. They're neutral to the whole thing, right? We don't have that. And occurrences, and the way it is for us is that we don't have to exert force directly against anything. We can sub that out to someone else through a government. If we had, and even though we do have a purely voluntary military, you know, there are people who are willing to do it for pay, and they're happy to go over there and do, and put their lives on the line and act out, put physical violence against someone else on behalf of their group. I think if everyone was allowed to opt in or out of this whole system, I think it might be a little bit more, I think you would be able to see what people really cared about more. Like, for example, and I guess technically there's nothing stopping this from happening anyway, because there are, for example, people from the United States and the West who went and joined ISIS to fight against their own country's soldiers, for example. We, of course, labeled those people as terrorists, but still, you know, that's a freedom that people have and are able to do.
Right. Slight tangent.
Sure.
I think a lot of the things that that happen with regard to the government, or with regard to what government agents do, you know, things happen that people largely think are wrong, but they get away with it because the violence is put on, it's somebody else, an agent is acting on behalf of the people. And so this is why, you know, a lot of people will balk at the question, actually. If someone is trying to propose, let's say, a tax, for whatever, you know, to, let's say, get better technology for the local school or something like that.
Sure.
Which basically, if anyone, you'll mostly get, you know, a unanimous vote, or at least an almost unanimous vote on, yes, we should do more things for the school. Because kids.
Because kids, yes.
Think of the children.
Think of the children.
But, you know, supposing there were people in the town who didn't want to pay this tax.
Say you didn't have kids.
Right, didn't have kids, don't want to pay the tax, or sent your kids to private school, didn't want to have to pay to put things in the public school, you know, whatever. You have your motives for not wanting to pay. Now, you ask somebody who supported the tax, okay, are you willing to grab a gun and go get the money from this person?
No.
Of course not.
But you kind of are, though, because you don't have to get your hands dirty. You can instead let someone whose job it is to go do that.
Right, but I think that's actually very dangerous that...
Well, yeah, because you get to benefit without any action of your own.
Right, well it's not even... Right, exactly. It's that... It has everything to do with the fact that one benefits from it. It's not because they think that it's right on like some sort of metaphysical level to buy more things for the school. It's that they see a possible benefit in the future.
An investment, right.
And they have no incentive to actually care about the principal because all they can do, raise their hand, say aye, or sign a piece of paper or whatever.
Cast a ballot.
Right. That says, I authorize somebody else to go execute this.
Right. And don't get me wrong. And actually, I think there is a metaphysical reason people are okay with that. Because in debates I've had before with people who favor something like socialism, even though they don't want to call it that because it's a dirty word now, but that's what they're supporting by doing this, they think that it is good for everybody, and so you should be forced. But you could pose the same question of, okay, if you think it's so good, would you donate money to do it instead of making someone else go get the money? Well, I don't, you know, there's some wishy-washiness there where they might say yes, but you can do that, you know. A good example of this is, look at the Trump wall. There are millions of dollars being raised through voluntary means to achieve a public work. That speaks so much louder than someone who's just willing to cast a ballot, you know. And I think, and that's another thing addressed in Heinlein's book as well, is that people can't be trusted with a vote because they don't personally have to carry it out. You know what I mean? Like in his book and in the philosophy he portrays, only veterans are allowed to vote. And the reason they're the only people trusted with the vote is because they're the only people that have demonstrated that they're willing to carry out the acts for which people vote. And it doesn't have to just be military service. That's one thing that the movie gets totally wrong, that the book talks much differently about. You could be a person who digs ditches for the state through the military, or works at a chemical treatment plant or whatever. You work for the people. But the thing is, you're putting yourself in the place of the actor who is doing the thing. You do it. You take the money from other people. You get out there and you do the hard thing yourself. You don't get to just delegate it to someone else. And then once you've done it yourself, you then understand what you are then putting on the next generation of people that are going to have to do the thing you vote for. And you understand the responsibility that you have. I don't think it has to necessarily be military service, but that's the thing, is there's a divorcing of responsibility from your actions by voting. And that's one of the biggest critiques of a democratic system anyway, or any system that emplaces a government, is that you're able to tacitly participate without taking direct responsibility. And I think that's one reason that people look at terrorism. I think that's one of the reasons people look at terrorism so negatively is because it confronts that very reality. Because if you read some of the things that were put out by bin Laden and a lot of his supporters, they say all Americans are responsible. But most people who are Americans said, oh, I'm not responsible. I didn't do that. But they have a point. You tacitly accepted to it. You know what I mean? You voted for this. You support the people who did this. And if you read our own documents, the government gets its power from all of us as an aggregate. And that's also kind of unfair as well. Because say you are the one person that votes against going to war that is wrong. You still supported it with your taxes, or you still supported it by participating in the system in a way. And there, and even if, don't get me wrong, you can resist the system from within by not, by tacitly denying authority here and there, but the whole system's unfair, you know. I think we're going to talk about social contract theory at one point, and that's the biggest gripe I have with social contract theory, is that you owe this body your allegiance and your participation and your support, or, you know what I mean, you're forced into this group of people who get to decide, and you're still responsible for the outcome even if you didn't vote for it. Even if you didn't vote at all, you're still responsible, you know. And I think it's really unfair to lop those people together, you know, when in reality, if you wanted something done, you better be willing to put yourself in the place of the person who's going to do it. Or at the very least, you know, do things to put your dollars behind it, you know, put your own property or your own self in that place. Because I think the divorcing of responsibility from action is a problem, because it blurs the lines on who is actually responsible. Because, you know, there will be some that say, well, I didn't go over there and shoot those people. And they're right. So they're not directly responsible in that way, but there's this really, really murky indirect responsibility that is full of weeds that some people say is, you know, the argument's fair to be made that you are still indirectly responsible or not. And the problem is we could avoid this whole discussion by just making everyone directly responsible for their own actions. So I think now, if you don't have anything else to say about that, I think we should tie this back to the original discussion, the original question asked, which we've been beating around the whole time, but I think there was a lot of groundwork that needed to be laid to get to this point. I accept your assertion that terrorism is just a bad label. It's just a opinionated label, essentially, on a person who's actually willing to act on their belief. Okay? And when it comes down to when a person does that, I don't think there is really an objective level. I think it is subjective on the individual's level. Now, whether or not it is right or wrong, I think, is not necessarily left up to the sum of the observers. But I do think that that's practically how it plays out. It's not left up to their opinion on it. It's left up to, well, how willing were they to act against you on it, you know? And we could go back to that. Like, let's go ahead and do the example we've discussed before. At what point do I need to begin to exercise my Second Amendment right to defend myself from tyranny? At what point is it tyrannical? At what point do I wield a gun against a state, you know, that is beginning to encroach on me? I don't know. But I do know that the point is essentially defined by the time when I actually do it. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what I say. I could say that it's when they come to take my guns. Like, when someone comes to disarm you, that's the point at which I would probably get my guns out and stop that from happening. Because that's kind of logically the point of no return. Because if they take away your ability to defend yourself, then it doesn't matter when you would use it, right?
Right.
But there very well could be a time before that. It just depends on when I'm actually willing to do it, you know. When the G-man comes a-knocking, you know, my first instinct is to reach for the handgun to defend myself, then that's the point. I found it, you know. It's kind of like saying, you know, a person can't afford to know their limits, but because you'll only know when the day comes, when you're actually going to do it. And that's kind of scary because you don't know when that day is. It's different for each person. But for a government, what they have to look out for is the day that the significant critical mass of people decide to do that, which can change, you know, via rhetoric and optics, it can change. Because clearly some people already got to that point. You know, the people in the Midwest who brought out guns against the state, or the people in Tennessee that, was it the Athens?
I think it was Tennessee, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, those people found their point, and it wasn't when people were going to come to take their guns. They just reached their breaking point, and not only did the individual reach his or her breaking point, but the critical mass of people that you can no longer contain without going to the next level. And that's an interesting point, too. The government didn't stop these things, even though they could. They didn't actually, because the point could be made that the U.S. government or the state of Tennessee or Montana could mobilize the National Guard to go out there and shoot these people. They could have gone to the next level, but they weren't willing to. So clearly it wasn't worth stopping. And that's equilibrium, is when one side has pushed to its boundary and says, this is as far as I'm going to go until you poke back. And the other institution said, look, I'll let you go that far because I'm not willing to stop you from going any further. If you go any further, I'll stop you. But if you, as long as you're right there, that's my breaking point. And when people have reached the edge of their breaking points, that's when you've reached equilibrium. And it's dangerous because you're essentially having to go to the tipping point every time to find that limit. But that is the real limit, is when two bodies are at their tipping points, but neither are willing to go to the next step, you know? And we call it terrorism when we disagree, but I think I agree with you when you say it's a meaningless label, because it doesn't matter if you disagree. Are you getting your gun to go fight against it? Are you showing up to put, and you don't have to, it doesn't have to be necessarily direct violence like that. Are you willing to go stand against it? Tiananmen Square style, you know, what's the point for you? And I think there's a truth there. I don't know if I've defined it adequately enough, but I think there is definitely a truth there, because that seems to be what happens, you know, especially in times of revolt or revolution, or when individuals come in contact against a state, you know, you quickly find where both people are willing to go and where they're not. And the line between those is where equilibrium actually is. And I think it's at that point the maximum freedom can be achieved, because you can maybe make the argument that those people still are bound by a system, but they're not going to get any freer than that because they're not willing to push for that freedom even further, you know? Yeah. So did that answer the core question? Or are we still beat around it?
I think that an answer has been given.
That an answer has been given?
I you know, there may or may not be more to say about it, but I think this definitely will give some folks something to think about, and it's given me something to think about, so.
Me too, because I'll be honest with you, this is the first time I've actually been able to take my ponderances on what Heinlein had laid out in his book and actually put them into a practical context. And it's an interesting philosophy. I definitely think I don't think it's 100% correct, for sure. But I do think it points at the reality. And that's what we had discussed about looking for truth. It's truth is not about what seems right or what we seem to agree with. It's about the laws by which reality will play when set out in the system, you know. And it gets complicated with people because people are subjective in a way. And so they may not do everything the same way. Even the same person might act differently in the same instance twice, you know, free will aside and all that. But I think when it comes to finding nuggets of truth, or, you know, what seems to be the most true, you know, like those really annoying test questions, which one of these is most correct? You know, which one of these seems to be the most in line with the truth? I think there's a lot to be said there. And don't get me wrong, I would really be interested in continuing this discussion. And I would really also appreciate hearing other opinions, because I feel like there's always a danger of putting yourself into mental gymnastics. And I feel like I may or may not have engaged a little bit in that today, and it's dangerous to get yourself worked into a place where, yeah, this seems right, because you modify the initial conditions to something they're really not to make it fit. But either way, for the sake of discussion, I think it's been very interesting, for sure.
So with that,
philosophers.